the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Bobby Kennedy, riots at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, the peak of the Vietnam War, and the Year of the Pitcher combined to make 1968 one of the most interesting and tumultuous years in American history. Good morning and welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown sitting in for Ann this week. And this hour, we're talking about 1968 and baseball. With us on the line is Tim Wendel, the author of 9 books, who's also had works appear in the New York Times, Washington Post, and other publications. His latest book is Summer of 68, The Season That Changed Baseball and America Forever. Tim, welcome back to All Sides.
Good to be back with you, Steve.
Listeners, what are your fondest memories of 1968? What are your worst memories, baseball and non-baseball stories? All welcome. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Email allsides at WOSU.org. You can also find the show on Facebook or tweet the show at WOSU All Sides. Tim Wendel, 1968, a very, very well-documented year, both for the Year of the Pitcher, the baseball season, and other news events of the year. I think you did a great job recapping it, but why write the book?
Well, I guess I was looking at that year, and one of the things that struck me, I channel surf a lot, drives my family crazy, and so I was channel surfing one night, and I live outside of here of Washington, and I was bouncing around between probably Fox and MSNBC and my local affiliates, and it dawned on me again, we don't really listen to each other, we just have these ongoing arguments, and one of the great things about history is you can look back and quickly find situations or times where arguably things were worse, and somehow we got through it as a country, and I soon landed upon 1968, which is far, far worse than anything going on today. As my friend Hampton Sides has said, it's probably the closest we've come to a second civil war in this country. I mean, we had the assassinations of Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy and riots in the streets, and I started to explore it, and I became more and more convinced that sports in general and baseball specifically helped hold us together, which maybe sounds a little bizarre because we like to divide up things and put things in different categories. But sports was very important that year, both as an example and also some of the individuals that rose to the forefront.
And baseball was still by far the most popular sport at that time?
Yeah, very much. I mean, it was still king. Football was coming on, which 68 kind of underscored how popular football was becoming. But baseball was still it. So much so that the Olympics, the Mexico City Summer Games, they didn't start it till after the World Series was over that year. Nobody went against baseball back in that age.
And just about every baseball fan has heard of 1968, mainly for the Year of the Pitcher. And there was one pitcher who stood out above all others, and it was Bob Gibson.
Yeah, and I think Bob is a good example of, in a sense, how politics, culture, and the game got all intertwined. Everything wasn't neat and tidy back then. And one of the things that I was struck by with Gibson was a very intense pitcher on the mound. I mean, he glared in at the hitters, etc. But he did not get off to one of the best starts that year. Early on in 68, he was overshadowed in the National League by Don Drysdale's scoreless inning streak. Ferguson Jenkins was off to a pretty good start. American League, we had the perfect game with Catfish Hunter, and Louis Tiant in Cleveland was well on his earned run average title. And so Gibson, he didn't stink it up, but he was not exactly front and center as 68 is getting going. And it wasn't until after Bobby Kennedy's assassination in early June of that year at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, that somehow things clicked for Gibson. He's got a famous line. He said something effective, when they killed Dr. King in April in Memphis, I was saddened, I was distraught, I was shook. But when they killed Bobby Kennedy, I became infuriated. And he somehow was able to channel this passion, anger, even disgust at what was going on around him, into one of the most amazing runs ever, I think, in baseball history. He pitches his first shutout of the summer of 68 in his first start after Kennedy's assassination. Goes on to pitch 13 shutouts, 28 complete games, and an earned run average of 1.12. And I think among baseball folks, you run those numbers by him and they go, wow, we'll never see the likes of those again.
And that was a really incredible run there. As you say, Bob Gibson was just as much for his pitching ability. He was also known for his intimidating the way he carried himself on the mound. Let's take a listen to a piece of sound from an ESPN documentary.
Bob Gibson was the most intimidating pitcher that ever played a game.
If you wanted to put the term true warrior to a baseball player, he was it.
Bob Gibson was the meanest of all pitchers. Not only that, but he worked the hardest at projecting the image of being the meanest of all pitchers.
And later in that same documentary, David Halberstam says Bob Gibson taking the mound wasn't just pitching, it was an act of war. And was Gibson liked by his fellow players? I'm sure he was very well respected, but was he liked? Was he did players care for him?
No, I don't think he was especially liked. But I think people, certainly as his career went on, and certainly after the numbers he put up in the summer of '68, Steve, I think he was more, in a sense, better understood. In essence, he was one of the prominent African American athletes of that era. And I think it was it wasn't until later we kind of realized how difficult it was for prominent black players to play, to be the staff ace on the world champion team as he was then, to be perhaps the starting quarterback, to be a middle linebacker. All those type of positions weren't really there at that point for black athletes, and Gibson was certainly one of the ones who kind of put it on the forefront. And I think I'm struck by, again, one of the scenes that I love in Summer of 68, and it took me a long time to vet it out, was that Bob Gibson and Dr. Martin Luther King pass each other in the old Atlanta airport in late January of 68, you know, before the season gets going, mm-hmm. Unfortunately before King's death in Memphis. And they just kind of nod at each other. They don't really say anything, but they nod at each other. And Gibson was of the mind later that, oh, you know, Dr. King, I mean, he was a great leader. He probably wasn't even sure who I was. And yet I got talking to a lot of folks in King's inner circle, especially who were with him in Memphis. And they were insistent, of course, Dr. King knew who Bob Gibson was. In a sense, we looked upon sport, we looked upon, in a sense, America at that point in a slightly different way than maybe other people did. We were watching to see if people of color were being allowed to be the staff ace for the world champion ball club, if they were being maybe allowed to be quarterback. And so in that sense, they were watching sports in a far different way and were very complimentary and very almost in awe of what Gibson was doing.
We're speaking with Tim Wendel, the author of Summer of 68, The Season That Changed Baseball and America Forever. Give us a call. Share your stories from 1968. Call 614-292-8513. Again, 292-8513. You can also email the show, allsides@wosu.org. Send us a message on Facebook or tweet the show at WOSU. All sides. Another player deeply affected by King's death was Curt Flood, of course, a really good player on those same Cardinal teams, but definitely best remembered for his role in changing baseball labor rules in a case that went before the U.S. Supreme Court. And I guess this is somewhat of a sidebar since that actually played out in 69 and 70, but it had a profound effect on the economics of baseball going forward after that.
Yeah, very much so. And very much the seeds of what Flood ends up doing. In a sense, Flood challenges the reserve clause in baseball and pretty much opens up this era of free agency and really the big money we have today. Before Flood decided to take his case to the Supreme Court, pretty much, you know, even if you didn't have a contract with a ball club, you were still, in a sense, their property until something else happened, until another ball club took over. And it's interesting to talk with teammates of Curt Flood's from that great St. Louis team. And I think sometimes that St. Louis team doesn't quite get its due. I mean, they had won a championship in 64, a World Series. They had won in 67, beating Boston, and arguably should have beaten Detroit in 68. And mm-hmm. to a lot of people inside the game, they feel they should have been recognized as a dynasty. And they lose the series pretty much on a line drive hit by Jim Northrup of the Tigers that Curt Flood, you know, who had been heralded as the best outfielder in the game. He had been on the cover of Sports Illustrated earlier that same season.
Gold Glove winner.
Yeah, he misjudged it. And it's, you know, it sailed over his head. There may have been extenuating circumstances. The field was beat up. It was slippery, etc. But Flood was so distraught after he felt that he'd lost his team the World Series that, in a sense, he then went ahead with this kind of almost Don Quixote type of attempt to strike down the reserve clause. And you talk to some of his old teammates, Orlando Cepeda, Mike Shannon, et cetera, they feel if he'd made that catch, then maybe he doesn't feel he's got to, you know, in a sense, go off and, you know, try to champion this cause in the courts. Because he was warned very early on by Marvin Miller and others, in a sense, this will end your career. You know, not only will you be, in a sense, an outcast from baseball, but it's going to take up so much of your time that probably you're not going to be in the shape you're going to need to be to carry on in the game. And Flood said, fine, you know, I want to do it. And I think it's two events, him misjudging perhaps that line drive in Game 7, and also that he was very distraught over Dr. King's death. And he felt he had gone with Dr. King on some marches and such, and he felt he should be doing more. And he felt maybe striking down the reserve clause was his chance to do more.
Baseball had delayed the start of the season because of the King assassination, but did not cancel any games because of Bobby Kennedy's murder, except in New York and Washington.
Right.
And that ruffled the feathers of some players like Rusty Staub, who refused to take the field.
Yeah, I think it was a real one of several instances in that season in the summer of 68 where baseball kind of dropped the ball from a leadership standpoint. I mean, you talk about, you know, inadequate leadership. Okay, we're going to cancel the games in New York and Washington after Bobby Kennedy, who at that point, after winning the California primary, appeared to have the inside track to the Democratic nomination for the presidency. And we're going to leave it up to all you other teams. You guys vote among yourselves and decide if you want to play or not. Boy, you talk about putting the divisive issue into the clubhouse. And it really pulled some teams apart. Players like Rusty Staub, Maury Wills, Milt Pappas really got in trouble with management who wanted to play the games, and they were feeling that they shouldn't, you know, their team shouldn't play the game. Ironically, one team that in an offhand way benefited from this was the New York Mets. The New York Mets were getting ready to play the San Francisco Giants on the West Coast at Old Candlestick Park. And Gil Hodges, their manager, went around in the hotel the morning after Kennedy's assassination and pretty much told, he spoke with pretty much every ball player. He said, do not show up at the ballpark. Do not go. We are not going to play. And the Giants were very upset about this. They had a huge walk-up gate. It was bat day at Candlestick. They had probably had more than 40,000 tickets sold. The game did not go off. And for a while, the Giants even threatened to sue the Mets. Now, of course, baseball fans will know the Mets go on to win it all the next year. Upset, you know, the Orioles in the World Series, become the amazing Mets. And you get talking to some of those old Mets, and they say, we really started to come together as a team when we kind of stuck up, in a sense, for each other. And Gil Hodges, in a sense, said, we're going to make a stand as a team. We're not going to play the day after Bobby Kennedy's death.
We're speaking with Tim Wendel, the author of Summer of 68, The Season That Changed Baseball and America Forever. We'll have more on the book in just a moment. You're listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News, also streaming at WOSU.org/allsides.
Amid the debate on gun violence, some epidemiology. If you're white and died by gunfire, you likely lived in a rural area, opposed strict gun control, and committed suicide. If you're black and died by the gun, you were likely shot by someone else, lived in an urban area, and supported gun control. I'm Neil Conan. Race, class, gun deaths, and gun policy. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This afternoon at 2 on 89.7 NPR News.
And this is 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. 33 degrees in downtown Columbus. Some snow showers are likely today, little to no accumulation, though, and a high near 38 degrees. Cloudy skies for tonight, a chance of some light snow in the evening, a low of 29. And looking at Wednesday, mostly cloudy with an isolated snow shower and a high near 40. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, and then I'll watch them roll away.
Otis Redding there with Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, one of the great hits of 1968. Good morning, I'm Steve Brown, sitting in for Ann Fisher, and today on All Sides, we're talking about baseball in 1968. Our guest, Tim Wendell, the author of Summer of 68, the season that changed baseball and America forever. And Tim, we have spent quite a bit of time talking about the Cardinals this morning. We do have a caller on the line who would like to talk about the team that actually won the World Series that year.
The Tigers.
Bill from Powell. Bill, go ahead.
Hey, Tim, I lived in Toledo, listened to WJR, and followed the Tigers the year before when they came so close, and obviously watched them through 1968 with all their colorful players and so forth. It was great, and certainly the World Series. So how far in the book do you cover the success of the Detroit Tigers, or ups and downs, 31-6 and coming from behind, et cetera?
Oh, yeah, the Tigers are huge players in the summer of 68. I don't think you can, you know, do a book about this summer without them. And I think one of the things that sometimes forgotten about the Tigers is such what pressure they were under as the season of 68 begins. And what had happened was, of course, Detroit had the riots. They'd had, in a sense, huge swaths of that city had actually burned the year before. In many ways, Detroit was kind of the canary in the coal mine of what was coming down in 68. And so what happened was a lot of the Tigers had been told by police, city officials in the Detroit area, hey, it'd be really good if you guys won. They had come within one game the year before. They had lost the year before with Boston winning it. And they were told pretty much it'd be great if you guys won, because not only would it be fun to win a pennant, but maybe you just might save the city. I can't think of another team that started with more pressure under it than the Tigers did that year. And amazingly, they rose to the occasion, too.
And they came from behind so many times for not so much Mickey Lolich, but Denny McClain and people like that. It was a great year.
Yeah, it was an amazing year, and I think it helped hold the city together in many ways. And one of the things that struck me was you're talking to some old city officials, from Detroit from that era, and they talk about in 67, if you saw a group of people on the street, that could be trouble. You know, in a sense, who knows where this is going to lead. They soon learned in 68 that a group of people gathered on the street corner were probably listening to the transistor radio and Ernie Harwell calling the action. And as you say, the Tigers made a habit of 68 of rallying from behind and coming back from the eighth inning or later. And it got to the point that it really quieted down the city. Even when the Tigers were losing, people would kind of say, oh, well, just hang on. They came back last night. Maybe they'll come back again tonight.
Well, good luck on your book.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Bill. In your book, you did paint a really interesting scene that really set the tone for Detroit in 67. Mickey Lolich, the great left-handed pitcher we were just talking about, during the day he was in a Tigers uniform, and then at night he was in a National Guard uniform holding a knight and guarding a supply depot. And that really kind of shows this this clash of culture that was going on in Detroit.
Well, I think it speaks in a lot of ways, Steve, to how in the summer of 68, athletes were in a different place, so to speak. They were still very much a part of our community. It isn't like it is today with so much money that they don't really live among us anymore. Mm-hmm. And so the athletes were directly impacted by what was going on. They felt it as much as anybody. I mean, the scene you're alluding to is Mickey Lolich pitching, you know, it's the day Detroit starts to burn in 67. And he pitches the first game of a doubleheader it's a Saturday doubleheader. By the end of the second game, he's gotten his orders that, no, you're going to need to switch out of that Detroit Tiger baseball uniform, and it's time to get into your National Guard fatigues, because your unit is going to be helping patrol downtown Detroit against the riots. And another incident that I find striking from that same day is Willie Horton, who had grown up in the projects of Detroit, an outfielder for the Tigers. You know, here's Lolich going off to join his National Guard unit. At the end of that second game, Willie Horton is driving down to where the riots had started, still wearing his baseball uniform, climbs up on top of a cab and pleads with people to stop. Unfortunately, not enough listened to him, but this is how, you know, tight the ties were. This is how much the links were between the players and the communities back then.
We have another caller with a question about Bob Gibson and the Indians. Mike from Hilliard, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Well, before the Indians, one of the funniest lines I heard about Bob Gibson was Hank Aaron was on the David Letterman show a couple years ago, and he said, Bob Gibson would throw at you when you were on the on-deck circle.
That's about right.
Now, I think the 68 Indians set a record for ERA that year.
Yeah, you're right. And they had, you know, not only McClain, but you had Sudden Sam McDowell. And frankly, I think one of the best lines I heard regarding, say, Louis Tiant, who is like, starts coming into his own that year with Cleveland, with the Indians, is Bill Freehan, the catcher for the Tigers, who is, in a sense, catching Denny McClain, who wins 31 games and such. And somebody asked him at one point about Louis Tiant, and he goes, oh, yeah, Tiant's got much better stuff than McClain. I mean, if Tiant was here with us on the Tigers, he'd win 40 games. So it was just a matter of not enough hitting at that point in time for Cleveland.
And one of the big injustices when we talk about Hall of Fame players was Sudden Sam McDowell. He's in the top 10 in three different categories: hits per game, which is against him, strikeouts per game, and looking for the third one here. I have it. I can't find it now. But he's in the top 10 in three different categories of all the pitchers of all time, and nobody ever talks about him.
Yeah, and I think you talk to certainly batters, opposing batters from that era. They sure talk about him.
Oh, yeah,
they
here's the other top 10. I'm sorry, here's the other top 10. He's in the top, he's number 8 in batting average. So he's one of the greatest pitchers of all time, and he never gets a whisper when they talk about Hall of Famers.
Yeah, well, maybe the Veterans Committee will do right by him at some point. But, you know, like I say, hitters from that era certainly knew about him, and they certainly respected that entire Cleveland Indians pitching staff.
Yeah.
Well, Mike, thanks very much for the call.
Again,
we're speaking with Tim Wendel, the author of Summer of 68, the season that changed baseball and America forever. Please, listeners, give us your calls, give us your questions and comments about 1968. Share your memories. 614-292-8513. Again, that's 614-292-8513. You can also email allsides@wosu.org. Find the show on Facebook and also tweet at WOSU. All Sides. And Tim, we're talking about, we talked about the riots and the strife in Detroit, also raging at this time. A lot of the protests were centered around the Vietnam War. A lot of players had military commitments. How else was the Vietnam War kind of coloring the summer of 68 and the baseball season?
Well, I think going back, you know, I think Lolich, for example, he's not an aberration. You know, I love, Steve, those, I still buy them all. You know, I'm doing it right now. Beginning of the season, I love all those season previews, and I kind of look at them and, oh, you know, they predict this team to do well, et cetera. One of the things I was struck by going back and looking at the season previews for this time, say 66, 67, 68, was in retrospect they should have had almost a little side category. How many of these players on this active roster in essence are have military commitments? How many of them have to serve in the National Guard or elsewhere? Because it just could, you know, they were doing their patriotic duty, but it wreaked havoc with their, in a sense, their baseball career. And Lolich is a great case in point. I mean, you had several of them almost every team. For example, Nolan Ryan almost quit baseball because he was having to go back to Texas and serve in a National Guard unit that looked like before the Tet Offensive was going to have to actually go to Vietnam because they were very good at building bridges and this type of thing. Lolich, his National Guard unit was in Alpena, Michigan, which is roughly about 200 miles north of Detroit, and he had nobody really to throw to. He you know, here he is several weeks at a time up there, and he's trying to figure out how he can stay at least a little bit sharp. And at one point, he told me he ended up pitching to a priest. He found the priest in Alpena, Michigan.
Yeah, I remember that from the book.
And he ended up hitting the priest in the chest and the shin and maybe grazing his nose and something like this. And finally, Lowage said, I had to stop throwing to the priest because, you know, when I'm dead and gone, I think I would probably be going in the wrong direction the way I was beating up that priest. And so this was something, again, the athletes weren't removed from us. They were having to, you know, figure out and deal with all these tumultuous things as much as the common person was.
And trying to imagine a modern athlete, especially a very popular, very well-paid one, being involved in the military is almost unimaginable these days. So you have Bob Gibson at the absolute peak of his powers in 1968, this bubbling cauldron ready to explode in Detroit. And then, as fate would have it, the two teams meet in the World Series. And it's a classic World Series. As you say, you can make the argument that St. Louis should have won, could have won. Set the scene again for the World Series and how these two teams met up.
Well, I think one thing people need to remember is that the game or just sports has been clouded a little bit too. The World Series was the top team, only one team from the National League and one team from the American League going directly to the World Series. There was no divisional playoffs. There was no wild card. It was the number one team playing the number one team. And so, in a sense, you had to prove it over this long season and become like the top team, and then you had to prove it again in a very short best-of-seven series. And the Cardinals got off to a tremendous start. I mean, Gibson strikes out a World Series record 17 in the first game, is so locked in he doesn't realize he's broken the record till Tim McCarver, his catcher, goes out to the mound and pretty much shows him, you know, tells him to look at the scoreboard. You know, you've broken the record. And the Cardinals go off to a 3-1 lead, and it looks like they're going to wrap it up. And it looks like they're going to win their third World Series in, what, 5 years? And 4 years. And so they have the upper hand. And they kind of let their foot off the accelerator, I think, just a little bit. One of the things I love about baseball and sports is you can kind of play what-ifs and say, what if they had done this? And they've kind of forgot that they had a pretty good young pitcher in their bullpen. Now, granted, he had a couple of appearances during the 68 series, but he never got a start. And it was a young Steve Carlton. And you kind of wonder, that would have been interesting if Steve Carlton would have started game 5 or 6 or whatever. The Tigers start coming back. Pretty much their rally cry for a couple games was simply, let's save face, you know, let's save some face here a little bit where we're embarrassing ourselves. And another thing we have to remember is nobody had really seen the Tigers. The Tigers were one of these teams, except when McLean was pitching for his 30th game, were rarely on national television. You couldn't even have cable or a satellite dish to pick up all the games. And so they felt they weren't putting on the best show for America that was maybe getting their first glance at them. And they start coming back. One of the things they had been trying to do was throw out Lou Brock on the base pass, a great base stealer for
the
Cardinals.
Good luck with that.
And they kept trying and trying. And then finally they threw out Lou Brock at home plate in Game 5, which a run that if Brock would have scored, players on both sides feel the Cardinals would have taken the series. And it became the front image of our book, Summer of 68. You know, that's how close the play was. And from there, things turned. And the Tigers come back. McLean, who has not pitched very well in the World Series at all, wins Game 6 on short rest. That sets up the stakes with Lolich, who always believed he got, you know, playing kind of little brother or, you know, whatever, kind of lost in the shadows of the great Denny McLean. He's watching McLean pitch on short rest and win Game 6, and he's in Mayo Smith, the Tigers manager's ear, saying, I can do that. I can do that. And he did. And still, Lolich is the last guy, the same guy who's pitching to a priest in midseason in Alpena, Michigan, becomes the last guy to pitch 3 complete game victories in the World Series, and they win.
Yeah, just a classic World Series. Again, listeners, give us your call. Share your memories of 1968, be it about baseball, Martin Luther King Jr., Bobby Kennedy, the DNC riots in Chicago, the Vietnam War. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, 292-8513. You can also send your emails to allsides@wosu.org and tweet the show at WOSU All Sides. And Denny McClain really was a house on fire that season. And he didn't have, I mean, I wouldn't say he had a prolonged great career. He was a quality pitcher, of course, but this miraculous 31-game season, how did this happen? How did he win 31 games in 1968?
Well, again, it's one of those numbers you put out there, like Gibson's 1.12 ERA, and you're going, well, we're never going to see that again. And it's interesting because we were talking about Gibson earlier and how Gibson could channel anger, passion, whatever, into his next start on the mound. McClain went about it in a much different way, yet a very human way, I think, too. He kind of felt he was going to use his celebrity and use his stardom to kind of just rise above it all, you know, somehow play the jokester, you know, et cetera. One of the lines I love about McClain is they ask him roughly about the All-Star break in the summer of 68, and they say, Denny, what's your real goal here? You know, is it to have the team finally win the pennant? He came close in 67, but the Red Sox beat you out. Is it to win 30 games, be the first guy in decades to win 30 games at the big league level? And then he kind of thinks about this, and he says something effective, well, those will all be good, but I'd really like to be on the Ed Sullivan Show. And,
and got to admire honesty.
Yeah, and he played the Hammond organ. He was an accomplished musician, and he became kind of the next celebrity athlete following in the footsteps of maybe Babe Ruth or even Dizzy Dean. And that's the way he kind of rose to the top. And nothing really affected him that much. He would show up 20 minutes before games that he was pitching sometimes and still win them. And he just had some fun. And one of the scenes I love is he's the guy who kind of grooves the fastball to Mickey Mantle so Mickey Mantle can pass Jimmy Fox on the all-time hits list. And it gets to the point that McClain is on the mound yelling into Mantle up at the plate, where do you want the ball? And Mantle just kind of signals, oh, about chest high, inside part of the plate. That's where McClain puts it. Mantle hits it out. Mantle goes around the bases, doffing his caps, yelling thank you to McClain. And then the topper of that great story is Joe Pepitone, the great young Yankee hitter, is watching this whole thing from the on-deck circle, steps in against McClain, signals like Mantle has done, oh, inner half of the plate, about chest high. And, of course, the next one comes in at Pepitone's head and sends him down to the ground.
Well, that's a great story, as always. And Denny McClain, I think, lost 20 games just a couple years later.
Yeah, and it's, you know, he kind of made a pact, I think, with the devil when it came to cortisone shots in the summer of 68. We've kind of lost track of how many cortisone shots he took in the shoulder, but it's, from what I've been able to ascertain, it's well over 15. But one of the things I love about, and this is a great thing about sports and maybe just stories in general, Steve, is that here you have two very, very different individuals. Bob Gibson, you know, serious, gruff, you know, doesn't, you know, eye for an eye kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And then you have Denny McClain, who's at times seems like he's in it for the fun. Both of them become the MVPs and the Cy Young winners of their respective leagues. Okay, makes sense. But the stat that I love with both of them is, okay, you got Gibson's 1.12 ERA. You've got Denny McClain's 31 victories. Both of them pitched 28 complete games. So here you have two individuals coming to success in very different ways, yet they both were real workmen when it came to performance on the mound.
We're going to talk more about Denny McClain. We're going to talk more about the Tigers, Bob Gibson, more about baseball, and 1968. We're joined by Tim Wendell, the author of Summer of 68, the season that changed baseball and America forever. I'm Steve Brown, and this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're also streaming at WOSU.org/allsides.
After England and France went to war with Germany in 1939, there was a ferocious debate in America over whether the U.S. should come to their aid or go even further and enter the war. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the isolationists and interventionists with Lynn Olson, author of Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over World War II. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
And this is 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. And stay with us in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour two of All Sides begins, and it's Tech Tuesday, a discussion of museum technology, computers on wheels, and the latest gadgets. That's Tech Tuesday from 11 till noon. 33 degrees with some light snow. Snow showers are likely for today, but little to no accumulation, a high of 38. Clouds for tonight, some light snow continues, a low of 29 degrees. And then cloudy with an isolated snow shower again on Wednesday with a high near 40. Support comes from OSU's Department of Neurology, conducting a planned emergency study to see if progesterone can improve the outcomes of a traumatic brain injury, or TBI. Details on the PROTECT study, including a community opinion survey, and how to opt out of the study, are at protectiii.com. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
And John Fogarty there with center field must mean we're talking about baseball. Good morning. I'm Steve Brown sitting in for Ann this week. And we are talking baseball. We're joined by Tim Wendell. He's the author of Summer of 68, the season that changed baseball and America forever. We've been talking quite a bit about the Detroit Tigers this morning. And we do have Don calling from Mount Vernon with a Tiger story. Don, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for the show. I grew up in Michigan and I was 14 years old that summer, and I'd lived and breathed Tiger baseball my whole life. And boy, I'm telling you, that was a summer. I remember Joe Sparma, a classic ne'er-do-well pitcher, won the clinching game against the Yankees. And anyway, the story, I'm sure it's in the author's book, I haven't read it, but is about the great pinch hitter Gates Brown. He was called on to pinch hit one day early in the game. Ordinarily, he wouldn't pinch it till 6th or 7th, and he was always in trouble with Mel Smith, the manager, for being overweight, and he didn't expect to be called on so early, and so he had the clubhouse boy go get him a couple of hot dogs, and he was down at the end of the bench eating hot dogs, and about the 3rd or 4th inning, he got called on to pinch hit. He didn't want to see Mel Smith with his hot dogs, so he stuffed them down his pants. And as you can imagine, he actually got a hit, and he went in the gap, and he had to go around at first. He said, "I got to go into second." He slid into second. Got everybody in the clubhouse except the manager do, and he stood up. He had mustard and onion and ketchup all down his pants.
I spoke about that time with Gates, and he said he that's one of the only times he can remember he wishes he struck out.
And it's really just, you know, he was, those guys were like that. They were all from Michigan. I mean, so many of them were from Michigan, and they all came up together through Syracuse. It was one of the last teams that was really pretty much home produced. They got McLean from the White Sox. But,
right. Well, it's funny with those guys. Even today, Gates, Willie Horton, Mickey Lolich, Mickey Stanley, until recently Jim Northrup before his death, they would still get together for lunch. They still get together for lunch about every other month. And when the waitress comes around, she looks at Gates, African-American athlete, and Lolich always orders for him. And he always says, cheeseburger, fries. That guy will have cheeseburger, fries, and a shake. And, and the story behind it is they were both together down in the South, coming up through the Tigers organization, and of course Gates Brown couldn't go in a lot of the restaurants, and Lolich should be always the guy who ordered for him. And
I did know that.
And it's funny, you know, even though Gates will say sometimes, I kind of wish Mickey wouldn't do that all the time, because maybe some days I maybe want something different than a cheeseburger, fries, and vanilla shake. But.
Right.
Well, Don, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you, Don.
Tom, Don's story does really, you can tell the intimate relationship that fans had with sports back then, much more so than they have now, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, the irony is, Steve, that, you know, I can see tons of highlights about my favorite player. I mean, I can see them, you know, I can see them on YouTube, I can look on ESPN, etc. But the odds of me seeing my favorite player walking down the street in my hometown are next to nil. And I think that's been the flip. I mean, you know, TV has kind of taken over, the money's gotten better, but the athletes kind of live in this rarefied air of, you know, ESPN highlights and not really among us anymore. And so many of these guys, as you know, last caller and previous ones have pointed out, these players are part of the community, and these stories, you know, almost get kind of handed down, and in large part because so many of them were able to share in kind of almost this one-on-one relationship that doesn't exist now.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Tim Wendel, the author of Summer of 68, the season that changed baseball and America forever. Listeners, give us your stories from 1968. 292-8513. That's 614-292-8513. You can send your emails to allsides@wosu.org, and you can also tweet the show at WOSU All Sides. We have another Detroit story here. Dan on the line from Akron. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. You know, the 68, was that the year the riots were going on, the unrest in Detroit?
Well, it's pretty much the season after, but pretty much all the ball club kind of rose to the occasion and actually helped quell any more riots after that. But it's, you know, I don't think Detroit as a city, unfortunately, has ever really recovered from those riots of 67. So it's one of the things that I do in summer of 68 is my good friend Tom Stanton, who's a great writer, lives up in the Detroit area, kind of took me on a tour of around Detroit as it is now. And I grew up with some family up in Upper Michigan, and so I'd been through Detroit in the past, but I was struck by how much the city has changed, where you have just huge swaths of nothing. You can be driving through a neighborhood and suddenly you get into something where there's no street lamps, no buildings, etc. They're talking about bringing farming back into the city of Detroit. They're talking about having cattle and such. It's amazing what's happened to that town.
Yes, I remember 68, though, when it comes to baseball being the year of the pitcher, that the ERA, Carl Yastrzemski led the league in hitting with a 301 batting average.
And didn't they
like lower the mound after that year?
Yeah, they had a number of rule changes after they lowered the mound. They actually shrunk the strike zone a little bit. This is where discussion about the designated hitter really starts to take off. And I was on a panel a couple months ago with Jim Boughton, who wrote Ball 4, who was pitching during that era. And he was like going, they didn't have to do any of this. And I was going, what do you mean? The pitching was so dominant, they felt they had to up the offense. And he said, what they forgot was expansion. You know, they're rolling out with two teams in either league the following year in 69. That would have probably diluted the talent enough to give the hitters, you know, more of a chance, and things would have smoothed out. I find it amazing that here we had this great year. We still know is the year of the pitcher, and the powers that be in baseball didn't embrace it more, didn't just kind of salute this great, you know, not only veteran pitchers, but some of the young ones who were coming on, like Catfish Hunter and Teon, and even a young Nolan Ryan, et cetera, and then it kind of embrace it and say, this is what we are right now. We're having this golden era of pitching. Instead, they tried to fix it, and I think kind of messed it up.
Sorry, Dan, we had some problems with your phone line there. Again, as Dan's talking about the year of the pitcher, and you talk about Catfish Hunter, Carl Yastrzemski winning the AL batting title with a 301 average, an Astros and Mets game that ended 1-0 after 6 hours and 24 innings. You could go on and on. It really was this mythical year for pitching. Besides the higher mound, is there any other explanation for why this happened?
I think it was just this culmination, Steve, of in a sense, you had guys kind of going the last time around the block, certainly guys like Drysdale and, you know, maybe to a lesser extent, Ferguson, Jenkins, et cetera, but a really good kind of veteran core that rose to the occasion, augmented by all of a sudden these new young pitchers coming on. And I've had many discussions about this with Nolan Ryan, and Nolan didn't really excel in the summer of 68. It wasn't really till couple of seasons later, after he'd been traded to the Angels, he starts to come on. But he believes the mindset was much, much different then. He believes that a starting pitcher would go out to begin a game, and if you didn't finish the game, if you didn't pitch nine innings, didn't finish it up, it was almost a bit of an embarrassment.
You said Gibson and McLain each had 28 complete games that year?
Yes, and now we make a big deal if somebody has 10,
ten is on the high end.
And you talk to some of the old timers, whether it's Ryan or Mickey Lolich or you know, pitchers from that era, and they feel two things have really, you know, twisted the game and may not for the best. Number one, a quality start now is six innings. You know, it's not nine innings, it's six innings. And you almost see young pitchers these days, once they get through six innings, they're almost kind of looking to the bullpen like, you got somebody warming up, I've kind of done my job. And the other pitch counts, and pitch counts being, you know, once you hit, like, usually the golden number is 100, once you've pitched 100 in a game, especially young pitchers look to start coming out of the game. And that's really, again, you talk to the old-timers, it's unfortunate. Guys like Ryan said, in essence, they still believe you're in there, you're the starting pitcher. You start what you, you know, you finish what you start. And I don't think a lot of young pitchers today quite believe that.
Yeah, I'm sure the old-timers are offended that the term quality start even exists.
yeah, they probably are.
also, in that memorable pitching year of 1968, Don Drysdale, who kind of often goes overlooked, he 58 and two-thirds consecutive innings without giving up a run. Oral Hershiser would go on to break that record, but still nearly 59 innings, more than six games, without giving up a single earned run.
Right, and a phenomenal way to start off the year. And yet, this is one of the things I love with Drysdale is, again, we have this confluence of politics and baseball, et cetera. In Kennedy's last speech, the one he gives at the Ambassador Hotel after winning the California primary, the very, very first things he says, and he's not blowing smoke because Kennedy was a real sportsman, he kind of does a shout-out to Don Drysdale, saying, you know, a salute to Don Drysdale and a scoreless streak, you know, something effective. Maybe, hopefully we can be as successful in the long term as he has been. And, you know, people forget that 50 prominent athletes had backed Kennedy's campaign. Basketball players like Bill Russell and Oscar Robertson have recorded radio ads. One of the twists I loved, I didn't know this till I got into researching summer of 68, was that when Vince Lombardi, the famed Green Bay Packers football coach, steps down and simply, you know, becomes general manager, he's no longer going to coach the Packers, one of the very first telegrams he receives is from Bobby Kennedy. And Bobby Kennedy saying, you know, great run, Vince. Now, how would you like to join my team? And there was some real serious talk about Vince Lombardi being a running mate with Bobby Kennedy.
I had no idea about that
ticket. And one of the great twists I love is Richard Nixon, of all people, was looking at Lombardi being potentially a running mate with him until somebody finally in his campaign did some research and figured out, no, in the Lombardi household, it's the wife, Marie, who's a Republican. Vince is a Democrat.
And from Valerie on Facebook, the worst memory of 1968, waking up to news on a bedside clock radio that Robert Kennedy had been assassinated. She wasn't sure if she had heard it correctly and hoped that she hadn't. Again, she goes on, it was a horror. It hung especially heavy after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. and Bobby Kennedy's brother, John F. Kennedy. And the best memory of 1968, the exciting World Series and the Tigers' victory led by what she calls quirky, great pitchers. We do have another story here about the Tigers. Amy calling from Grove City. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning. Yeah, something that would never happen in this day and age, for sure. I was in like sixth grade and my brother in eighth grade, and we lived in the St. Louis area, and we were Tigers fans. And I sent a baseball, just wrapped it up, sent it to the Tigers, asked them to autograph it for my brother, and didn't even send, like, you know, stamped, self-addressed, anything to return it. But they did. They signed it and sent it back.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, wow. That's the sort of thing that sticks with you all your life.
I'm not surprised by that Tiger team. They would go the extra mile and have fun doing it. I can almost see that coming into the clubhouse and them passing it around and signing it and saying, well, somebody make sure it's got the postage and send it back.
Yeah, and I even remember it was in a pink box with flowers on it. My brother still has it in the same box, you know, and they signed it, sent it back. So, yeah.
Lamy, that's a great story. Thanks for sharing.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
And that does get back to the point that baseball players and athletes in general seemed more approachable at that time, more of a part of your community. And 1968, this epic year in baseball, was also a memorable year in all other sports. Joe Namath famously made good on the guarantee to beat the Colts in the Super Bowl. Bill Russell was still winning championships in Boston. Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists on the medal stand at the Mexico City Olympic Games. There was a lot going on in the world of sport in 1968.
Very much, and I think, Steve, a lot of the way we see sports now kind of it had its start back in this era, and you know, one of the things is football is now king. They didn't really know how popular football was until the famous Heidi game, which was between two AFL teams, old AFL teams, the Jets, Namath's Jets, and the Oakland Raiders, and they ended the game at 7 o'clock, you know, even though it was still going on. And that was a contractual agreement, and they went to a made-for-TV movie called Heidi, starring Julie Andrews' stepdaughter. And then what happened was the Raiders came back when everybody had gone off the air and scored two touchdowns in roughly the last 2 minutes and won the game. And this is before, certainly, internet and cell phones and everything. So most of the country went to bed thinking the Jets had won when the Raiders had won. And there was so much protest, so many calls coming into NBC, 30 Rock in New York, that the switchboard pretty much imploded. And that's when the powers and be in football kind of realized, oh, maybe we're more popular than maybe we think we are. And I think even today you can see remnants of this in some ways when, say, 60 Minutes is due on maybe on CBS and the football game is going longer. You know, 60 Minutes is delayed. That's now a contractual thing. The football will be played out. The other thing that we see that we almost consider to be matter of fact is live programming now from the Olympics. That started in 68. A new guy named Rune Arledge took it over for ABC and kind of said, why are we tape delaying all this stuff? Why don't we do more live stuff? And hence we have, you know, the epic moments of like Tommy Smith and John Carlos raising their fists on the medal stand. Etc. that a lot of people were able to see live for the first time.
We also have an email from Rick in Westerville that says, also don't forget about the USS Pueblo. So there's that. Tim Wendell, I could talk about baseball in 1968 forever, but we're out of time. Thank you so much for your time this hour.
My pleasure, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Tim Wendell is the author of Summer of 68, the season that changed baseball and America forever. This is All Sides. I'm Steve Brown, and you're listening here on 89.7 NPR News. We're also streaming at WOSU.org/allsides.